Welcome to the Strong Enough Podcast, where we talk about the challenges and celebrate the triumphs of people from all walks of life. I'm your host, Claudia.
And I'm your co-host, Jen.
Have you ever felt like you were wrapped up in feeling helpless, hopeless, and unworthy? Well, then we've got an episode for you. We need you to just come alongside us right now and come alongside this guest who is going to offer you some amazing insight on how you can flip that script and turn your life into one that you know is worth living. Please help us welcome Dr. Carter Check. Dr. Carter, we are so excited to have you here today on Strong Enough. How are you?
I'm doing great. Excited to be here. I've been looking forward to this all week, just in preparation, because I know this is going to touch a lot of people.
We are excited as well. And I'm amazed just looking at that picture behind you. And I know it's a story in itself that we're going to have to hear, right? I think, Jen, what do you think?
Especially, yes, as a photographer myself, I need to know the story behind. Is it okay? Is it a sunset or is it a sunrise?
That's actually a sunset. Yeah, okay. It's a sunset. So it was amazing, amazing day, amazing afternoon. It was a pretty cool story to go with it.
I love it. Well, we're going to get into that then. So before we do, I would love it if you would share a little about yourself with the audience.
Yeah. So I'm a medical ethicist and a clinical chaplain by degree. I work with the Department of Veteran Affairs. I'm a suicide prevention specialist. So I work fully integrated on a suicide prevention team. If you'd have told me I'd have been doing this 20 years ago, I probably would have had some choice words for you. but, you know, one thing I've learned in my life, according to my faith, God has the most ultimate sense of humor. And never tell God you're not going to do something, because probably what you're going to do. But I'm highly invested in my work. My oldest son is a sergeant in the Army. I was an Army Cav Scout. So I deal with my own stuff. You know, a lot of people, when they're like, hey, you were in the Army, were you a chaplain in the Army? No, I wasn't. That was like the last thing I was thinking about. But I deal with my own stuff. And I think it's the wounds and the storms that we go through that give us insight and wisdom. And you look, I don't have some predetermined journey I think anybody needs to go on today. All I want to do is walk with you, if you'll walk with me, and see where we go.
Love it.
I love it. And I'm excited for us to walk alongside you today. So we're about to pull a bunch of other people right along with us. I would love to start with your suicide prevention, because it is so necessary in society as a whole, but really in the military, you know, veterans, law enforcement, we see a lot of suicide in those areas. So what drew you to that?
You know, really, it was my story of what happened to me in South Korea when I was in the service. Because I'll say this, it's the wounds that don't have funerals. It's the losses that don't have funerals and the wounds that don't bleed that are so hard to navigate. When I did my doctoral dissertation at Vanderbilt, I did it in using outdoors as an alternative way to deal with PTSD, traumatic grief. And what I found out, I did a meta-analysis on 94 different research projects that connected suicidality to loneliness. Okay. Now, here's what I'll tell you. Diagnostic criteria for trauma, and not to get way out in the but diagnostic criteria for trauma, everybody knows it. Anxiety, depression, PTSD, sexual trauma, right? Things that you find in manuals, things that are coded, things that medication is made for. These are super important. They need a lot of attention, but I think they get way too much attention in comparison to non-diagnostic criteria, which is really my arena. Okay. What do you mean by that? Well, how do you measure helplessness, hopelessness, unworthiness, right? Things that are connected to shame. Are there pills for that? No. Are there screening for that? No. But I would argue, just working as a suicide prevention specialist in the VA and working with first responders for the last 11 years of my life, The things that really cause someone to blow their brains out or hang themselves in a tree are not the diagnostic stuff. That's just symptoms of. And what happens, especially in the scientific models, we focus so much on the symptom, we miss the person. We really do. And so when you think about helplessness, hopelessness, unworthiness, right? Those are the things that don't show up on an MRI. They don't show up on a clinical meeting, right? But they garner a whole lot of attention because of this. Everything I talked about, diagnostic and non-diagnostic, they're all drivers to isolation and loneliness. Those are the two worst risk factors, right? And isolation isn't always bad. You know, sometimes solitude is good. I even write about it, right? It's good to get off by yourself, recharge. Look, hey, if you're sitting on the side of a mountain by yourself looking at that, that's good. But
Perfect.
when isolation becomes an avoidance tool, come on, now you're in a bad spot.
Well, and I
Here's the
would still
deal.
even go further a little bit with that too, is like there is this huge difference between loneliness and solitude.
100%.
Like
Yes. Yes.
as like
And so,
Jesus did solitude with the Father. But the enemy wants you isolated and lonely because
Come
that
on.
separates you.
You're so on track there, Jim, because here's the thing. Isolation, it's not all isolation is bad, just like not all guilt is bad, right? Right? When guilt turns to shame, that's a whole different thing. But loneliness, I want you to think about this. When God created everything, he called it good. And there was one thing that displeased him, that man was alone.
It's alone.
So loneliness has been set up as the ultimate risk factor since creation. Whether you believe in God or not, loneliness is the pinnacle of risk factor. And here's the thing, because it's introspective, you can't look across a room and see who's lonely. Matter of fact, you could be surrounded by 100,000 people and still feel alone, right? So what has really motivated me for this space was kind of my own story, because I entered into isolation and loneliness and really didn't, when I entered into the VA to get help, they're like, oh, you got PTSD, you got PTSD, you got, I'm like, no, I don't have PTSD. Yes, I deal with PTSD, but that's not what I'm dealing with. This is more about my identity, my trust, my competence, right? My autonomy, my worth. And they didn't have a language for it. And so I just decided, you know what? At 35, I'm going to go to grad school and I'm going to figure some of this stuff out, which led me to 84-hour degree, Master's of Divinity, and then doing a couple of clinical residencies, really digging into moral injury. And really, moral injury is just a violation of what's right to you. And then that pushed me to my integrative chaplaincy degree at Vanderbilt, really just kind of working with spirituality, what gives you meaning, purpose, and values in the context of behavioral medicine. And then after I got that, I'm like, oh, I'm so glad I'm done, right? I'm Dr. Carter Check now, and I've been to Vanderbilt, right? And the Lord's like, you're not done.
Not
Because
yet.
when you think about moral injury, what's that an injury to?
Your soul.
And so I really started to, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, but also just driven to understand what's going on. Because here's the problem, especially around suicidality. So much attention is driven to what leads up to the point of death. But can we be honest about something? I don't think we get really good data on how to live from dead people.
No.
What we don't have is we don't have the data set of those who have suffered suicidal ideation and behaviors. And then here, a year, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years later, they're still alive. Why? Where's that data? Why are you still, how are you flourishing? Did you get a service dog? Did you enter a Bible study? Did you come to community? And that leads me to this. In my doctoral work at Vandy, here's what I found out. The only way to combat isolation and loneliness is to create community and connection. That's it. Just create community and connection. Get people out of the place of where they're in their own head and all of that, and get them around other people who can companion them. Just walk with them, right? And my oldest son is a sergeant in the Army. He's a Cav Scout. So I'm kind of leaned into this a couple of different ways. I know I'm called to keep people alive long enough to hear the word. And I know that there's such a heavy burden of transitioning from service to civilian life And I lived it. My son is going to have to live it. My nephew, who's in the army, is going to have to live it. And it just seemed like so much attention was being driven towards the symptoms and missing the people. And I think that's the critical part. So what I decided to do was I really started to think about moral injury and that idea of we focus so much on the injury. Well, what is moral injury and injury to? Okay. And what I really kind of found out here, I think, is that moral injury is an ethical issue. Now, it's an ethical issue and it has mental health impacts. It has spiritual health impacts. And a lot of times it even has physical health impacts. But when you say you have a moral injury, what you have to think of is that is an injury to whatever you conceptualize as being morally healthy. So in my PhD work in healthcare ethics, which I'm six classes away from, thank God, I really focus on moral health. And what does that mean? And what does that look like? And would it surprise you if I'm one of the few in academia who's actually writing about this?
I mean, it's not surprising. I mean, if you really think
Sadly.
about it, because most academia is not faith-based and don't look at it from a soul spiritual standpoint, that everything is
Right.
connected as well.
Yeah.
So I can see that.
I know that Jen is about to spit some more truth. So before she does that, I just want to take a moment to say I really appreciate you talking about those symptoms that, like check the boxes, because I think the other problem with that is those become diluted. And what I mean is I also have PTSD. Like real PTSD. And so I sometimes want to punch people when you hear them say, like, oh, I had to wait like 30 minutes in a line at the DMV. I have PTSD and I want to punch them. So I think a lot of these like anxieties the same way, where now they're just buzzwords a lot of times. And so people are now overusing them.
It's almost like it's cool. Like I have an anxiety
Right.
problem. It's like a badge of honor at this
Yes.
point.
Yeah,
It
and
becomes
it's
your
like,
identity, right?
yeah, and
Well,
it's frustrating, for those of us that actually deal with those things, and it's not cool and it's not trendy and it's not fun. So I just wanted to point that out, that I really appreciate on that side how you have kind of made that division and made that look into these things that you can't really quantify, because the things that we do quantify are being overutilized, which means they're being diluted, which means they're gonna start being ignored at some point. And saying I have PTSD is just gonna be like somebody saying I have red hair. Okay,
You know,
Jen, or
in Canada,
yeah.
they call it a combat stress injury. I like that better because an injury I can recover from. But when somebody says disorder, then that makes me kind of feel like, man, I'm boxed in here. And I want to say something first before I feel like Jen is going to go off too. When I talk about moral health or moral repair, I'm not talking about religion. And it's a common assumption. And honestly, it'll get in the way of healing. Moral repair is about restoring your sense of self, your integrity, your ability to live with what you've been through. It's about identity, not doctrine. It's about rebuilding your inner compass after it's been shattered, because that's what happens when trauma comes. Look, the universal connector of all traumas is loss. And it's the thing that's least addressed, like disenfranchised grief, ambiguous loss, right? Those losses that don't have funerals, like
Loss of innocence.
a miscarriage, innocence, right? Identity, an abusive parent, right? Even losing someone to suicide
Safety.
death, right? Yeah.
Or even
And
loss of
so
safety with a parent if you have an abusive
100%,
parent.
yeah. Moral repair is about reconnection, not confession. So you don't have to be religious to heal your soul. You just have to be human. And you got to be willing to face what broke so you can rebuild from a place of truth and meaning. And that's it. And that's why you need community and connection, because you can't have
Yes.
truth and meaning without community.
Right.
Right.
And for anybody who's watching right now versus listening, you see Jen and I looking down a lot because we're both taking notes. Like literally, this man is
Come on.
spitting some gems here. So if
Right.
you're not taking notes, get your
Re
phone
rewatch
out,
this.
open the notes app. Yeah, rewatch it again. And if you're listening, then you have to come watch because we're going to hear shortly about this beautiful photograph behind Dr. Carter, and he's going to tell that story. Before that happens, we're going to let Jen go off.
Come on.
Well, I mean, I was going to say, you touched on a ton of things. But I think the biggest thing too is that identity. Like, so again, we'll go back to you got to know who you are and whose you are. And then so many people who have been through trauma, again, your trauma doesn't happen in a vacuum. Usually there's so many other factors. There's, years of abuse or trauma that has gone on. And your identity becomes either your trauma or becomes your, what you said, your symptoms. Whether it's your moral or your diagnostic or non-diagnostic. Like, I know so many people that walk around with anger. Like that is their identity, and they would not know who they are if they weren't angry anymore. And when you get down to, again, spitting truth from the Bible, one clearly says that God knew he created a helpmate for Adam, but also we're supposed to do life together, community. You're never supposed to live in complete and total isolation. I mean, yeah, Moses went up in isolation and met with God, but guess what? He came back down to the people and lived in community. Same thing even with Jesus. Yes, he went out and was in isolation, solitude for a reason, but coming back to community. And that's the biggest thing, I think, is that we don't do well as a society, whether it's and I'll even say in the church. We don't talk about your identity. We don't talk about the truth in who you are, because when you know that, then when you talk about shame, you can be like, well, no, that's not my identity. God doesn't say that that's who I am. And that's where when you talk about the truth, is knowing what God says about you and says who you are, because the world doesn't determine that.
Oh my gosh. So you've drawn two things from me that I got to cover. The first one is this. Have you always heard in the Bible the story about where the priest will go into the Holy of Holies and they would tie a rope around his leg, so if he died in the presence of God, they would
They would
pull him
just.
out, right? Okay. Well, the Jewish Talmud shares a different story. And in the Talmud, they say that the rope was tied around the leg of the priest so that when he went into the presence of God and didn't want to leave, they could pull him back out to be with the people. Now, I like that depiction a little bit better than the one of like going into God's presence and being executed, right? But what it shows is how important the presence of God is for our lives. I was just reading this past week in Mark 6. And in Mark 6 is where you get the story about Jesus feeding the 5,000, right? And so they're sitting there and they're surrounded by people, and Jesus has been teaching to them. And now the disciples are exhausted. You can tell in their language. They're like, Lord, tell them to go away. And he's like, no, let's feed them. And they're like, what do you want us to do? Go buy like 2,000 denarii of food, right? And he's like, no, what do you have? And they say, well, we got a couple of fish and some loaves. And he's like, bring it to me. And the Bible says that he prayed, blessed it, and that as the disciples distributed the food, look, it didn't multiply right then. As they did the work and distributed what he blessed, it multiplied, right? And then it says he told them to go across the water, and he went up in solitude to pray on the mountain. Then the next thing you see is it says that he saw them in panic. He saw them in stress, right? They're in the boat, the storm is there, and it's not like, we're up on side of this mountain, we have a telescope and we're looking. He sees them in the spirit struggling, okay? And he comes down the mountain, and the Bible says that he intended to walk past them. And so here they are in the boat. They're struggling, fearing for death physically of their life, and then they see something that they don't know what it is, when they cry out to it, and it says that Jesus came over, and when he stepped into the boat, the wind ceased. And here is the part that has confounded me this week. Verse 51 and 52 says that they were astounded that this happened, but they still had not learned the lesson of the loaves because their hearts were hardened. And I just sat my Bible down, Jen, and I'm thinking, what did they not learn? What did they not learn? And I could hear it as clear as day. They didn't learn that when Jesus says something, it's going to happen. When he says, distribute the food, it's going to happen. When he says, you're going across the water, trust you're going to make it across the water because he said it, it's going to happen. That's what they didn't learn. And I think one of the biggest deceptions that I've experienced in my life, especially around Christians, okay, and you pulled this from me, so I'm going to roll with it,
Do it.
is that the enemy of our faith tries to get people positionally into a position, thought process. The worst strongholds are not demonic. They're
No.
systems of thought built upon emotions, okay? And he tries to get people positioned to where they're constantly trying to become something that they already
That
are,
or that
right?
they're not supposed to be.
Yes. You know, if you're in Christ, you know what that means. You know how you got there because it was him, not us, right? But if the enemy can get in there and get you to question that, get you to maybe perform, maybe it's something you got to do, then you're already defeated because you don't trust or believe. Like, the life of a Christian is not about getting more faith. The Bible says we've all been given the measure of faith. The life of a Christian is to renew your mind to destroy unbelief. It's the level of unbelief in your life that will hinder you from walking out the calling and the things of God in your life, right? How does that translate into suicide prevention? If you don't know who you are and your worth and what God thinks about you and how much he loves you, then you'll start to think, maybe this world would be better. I really believe I've lost nine veterans this year, five in the month of May. Okay. And I don't want you to hear that and be like, oh, I feel sorry for Carter. No, what I want you to hear is it's happening and it's happening all the time. Okay. And I really feel like outside of a murder suicide, you know, or someone kills someone and then takes their own life. I really genuinely feel like people who take their lives feel like they're jumping on a grenade, saving everybody else from the explosion. I really do. Like, I'm a burden to everybody, you know?
That's a
And
great
here's what I can
analogy.
tell you. The most staggering statistic that I've ever learned in my job is this one. Suicide survivors. Those that are left after someone has died by suicide. So the child of a suicider, right? The intimate loved ones, they are 175% more likely to die by suicide. But when we can stand in the gap and mitigate one, we're not just saving that life, we're saving generational lives, right? That's why it's
I
so
mean,
important.
and that actually reminds me of a family that I know where I live. Very sad. The son committed suicide. He was in high school. I think he was a senior. Right after his grandfather had passed away, then his father, after that, had passed away from cancer, and mom could not deal. And about 2 years later, it was actually last summer, she took her life. So it's one of the, and again, and I know because I used to deliver groceries to her. So like, I know how isolated she was. She didn't have a car. She lived in this beautiful house out in the middle of nowhere, but literally had, I mean, she wouldn't even let the neighbors come over anymore. Like she was very, very much isolated. So
And
again,
probably convinced she was a burden, right?
oh,
And the
100%.
world would be better without me, you know? So I'm just going to go ahead and help the world out,
Love
right?
it.
And the tragedy of that is the blast radius of a grenade, if you jumped on one, yeah, you could stop that. But the blast radius of a death by suicide isn't fragments, it's pain. being displaced. And that'll shoot right through anything physical. And it just goes as, they say statistically, 135 people are directly affected by every suicide death.
Wow.
I mean, I believe that 100%. And it's, and you talked about this a little bit earlier too, and this ties back to your faith, is a sense of hopelessness. Like, God gives you hope. If you do not have hope, that's a scary, scary place to be.
100%. And you know what? Loneliness feeds into hopelessness, and
Oh,
hopelessness feeds into loneliness. So if you get in that place, then
it's
you're
like
just
that's
in
a
that loop.
cycle. Yep.
Yes.
You got to get off the
And
merry-go-round, guys.
yeah, it's hard to get out though. It's like a hamster wheel.
Right. So like that's the thing. Like what are the tools that, if somebody's in such a dark state too, like how do they get reached? Or is this more of a like, talking and discussing this amongst people constantly to bring awareness, so then therefore other people might see. I mean, I don't know. Like, it's one of those catch 22s, because again, like you said, some people are like, I never saw the signs, but it's like,
Well, the reality is, Jen, is most of the time you see signs of improvement before somebody dies by suicide. People will say, wow, man, last time I talked to them, they really, they looked like they sounded like they were doing good, right? Because
like they rallied.
even false hope shows a sense of improvement. And when you've decided to take your life, there's a finality and there's a false hope connected to that because you finally made a decision. You're no longer in this,
Limbo.
liminal space, right? You've made a decision. And so that is, a lot of people are like, wow, they seem like they were doing so much better. Obviously there's signs. People start selling all their stuff and redoing their wills and you know what I mean? Like, giving everything away that you're like, what are you doing? Those are, but some of it's not as obvious, and it's those that have isolated into the place of loneliness that are the hardest to find. I get asked a lot, how do you handle suicide death? Like, what do you do? And it's pretty simple for me. I have to honor the way they decided to die, because it was their choice. I don't have to like it. I don't like it, okay? My job is to stand in the space. But by honoring their decision, that prepares me to be ready for the person that wants to live. I'm not stuck in the person who decided to die by suicide. I'm ready for the person who wants to live and flourish as a human. And that's just kind of my way of doing that, mentally, spiritually, because the reality is this: if somebody wants to die, they're going to die. And I think the focus is, you remember earlier I was saying what really drove me towards that healthcare ethics PhD was divinity degrees are not seen in the clinical world as like PhDs and like, right? And so to be a primary investigator and really get some of that quantitative data that I want to show life is the only way to do it is I needed to step into that and get that research degree, right? And what it has really shown me is we can stop people from dying, but if we don't show them how or why to live, they're just going to keep trying to die.
Ugh, they gotta have a
So we need to
reason.
support life. We need that information, right? We need that data. And I'll tell you, in my life, the best way to stand in the gap of suicide, and it's why I write about it, is nature doesn't just hold space, it tells the truth. And in the wild, there's no performance, there's no pretense. You can't fake stillness or you'll rush your healing. So whether you're hiking, sitting by a fire, holding a bow, listening to the water move, nature reflects back exactly where you are without judgment. And that honesty, what that does is it creates safety. And that's what we want, right? We need a safe space to reflect. So you're not just the trees or trails. You don't need just the trees or the trails to heal. It's what happens in you when you're out there. You slow down. You stop numbing, start listening. And slowly, the part of you that got buried under the shame, under the trauma, or the survival, that starts to breathe again. And then maybe that opens up to reaching out to someone. And then that opens up to being part of a community or a group. But if you're by yourself, just, I don't say do this in the cold, but just take your shoes off and go put your feet in like really great grass. Close your eyes, take deep breaths, and tell me you're not experiencing something bigger than yourself.
I mean, I'll be honest, that's amazing, and that's part of the reason I actually got into hiking and photography was
Come on.
because I love nature, but I'm also that's where I see God's hand. I'm a sunrise person. Don't get me wrong, I love a good sunset, but for me, sunrises, it costs you more to be able to witness one. So therefore, to me, I feel like they're so much more spectacular because, not everybody else is getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning to go witness that. But I mean, like even to I'm an avid hiker, and to me, like that's my solitude. That's my solitude with God and finding the nature. And I know when I get off balance, like Claudia knows this about me, like I'll be like, dude, we got to go hiking. Like I need to get out in nature because I'm feeling that disconnect. So, with not everybody's is a nature person, I get it, but it's God's creation, not man's. Like you constantly hanging out in your house or isolating, like that's man-made. Like get out into and God made a little bit and get outside of yourself and see that there is something bigger. And I think that's also part of it too, is when you're in such a depressive state, it also becomes very self-absorbed. You're focusing everything on you, on your pain, what you're going through. And I'll say, like, I've had a really rough year. Very open about it. But like for me, when I kind of get a little in myself, when I say that, like, I deal with a chronic disease, dealt with a lot of spiritual warfare this year. And it's so easy sometimes to isolate and sit in that. And but for me, it was like, no, you can't do this because then it'll turn into a depressive cycle or whatnot. So I always set up roadblocks now. I'm like, God, please convict my spirit whenever I start to head down that way. And for me, what helps? Reaching out to other people. I send people messages. How can I pray for you? Because when I get outside of myself and stop focusing on my pain or my disease, my trauma, I start focusing on other people. I'm like, wow, I've got some hope again. I've got, it's like that whole paying it forward thing too. But
Totally.
that's one tool that has always helped me when I see myself start to go in that cycle.
You know, the dichotomy of the sun coming up and the sun coming down, one of the things that I really love is when you watch a sunrise, you're reminded that just a little bit of light will dispel darkness.
Whoo,
And for
come on now.
me, because I'm a Cav Scout and I'm the person who I really feel designed to go into the darkness, the sunset reminds me that just like the light is there, the dark is coming, but I'm ready to attack and go into that space. And so you get both sides of that coin, right? And look, some people are coffee people, some people are tea people. But I haven't met many people that didn't love a good sunrise or a sunset. You know, it's just even when you're driving, you're almost wrecking taking a picture of it, right? Let me get this.
Not us, because that would be illegal. So
Yes, of course.
we do things legally
we would never
around.
do such a thing.
Use
But
your dash cam.
other people.
Yeah,
Well,
use your dash cam.
while we're kind of on this topic, this is the perfect segue for you to talk about this beautiful photograph and what led you to capturing this image.
So make no mistake about it. The Lord will always send you into places where you think one thing is going to happen and something completely different is going to happen, right? And so
Right.
this was a trip that I had planned with one of my best friends who lost his dad a couple of years ago, and they wanted to go fishing up in Montana, and they didn't get to. And then he went by himself one time, and he didn't really like that. So he's like, "Hey, will you go with me?" And I'm like, "Yes, but let's do this with a twist. Let's do a fishing combined hunting trip." Right. So we can fish, but we can also hunt. So I started looking for places in Northwest Montana, and I found a place that did a blast and cast. So not only
Okay.
did you get to fish, right, you also got to hunt black bear. And, you know, as you can tell from my shirt, hunt therapy is what I wrote my dissertation in. And when you see the word hunt, I don't want you to think the killing and harvesting of animals. I want you to think, what do you need to hunt after for purpose in your life to be the best version of you? And whether that's hunt, the actual art of archery or hunting or fishing or rock climbing or, like you said, hiking or anything, whatever you need to do, you do it, right?
Right.
And so we plan this trip, and then he decides he wants to take his two teenage daughters, and I'm going to take my oldest son who's in the army. So we plan this thing out, we make the trip, we go up there. This is the week after my book actually hit. Okay.
Okay.
So Healing in the Wild hits, and we're in Northwest Montana healing in the
In the
wild.
wild.
Yes.
Perfect.
And 2 days into this trip, my bear guide tells me that morning, my best friend died by suicide last night.
Oh my gosh.
So the rest of the week, I was less concerned about hunting bear, and I was more concerned about companioning him. Because here's the thing, if you take the word treat patients and you break that down in Latin, the word treat means to drag, and a patient is a passive long-term sufferer. So if your goal is to treat people, fix people, then basically what you're doing is you're dragging along a passive long-term sufferer. Now, I don't know about y'all, but that doesn't sound very empowering, does it?
I don't like that. No.
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 But if you
I'm going to
take the
call my
word
doctor now.
companion, if you take the word companion, right? And the word companion really comes from Dr. Alan Wolfelt. Go check him out. He's a grief specialist, but Dr. Wolfelt writes a lot about companioning. But I'm married to a Latina, so I got a little mi español un poquito, but I got a little bit, okay? If you take the word companion and you break it down, calm is with and pan is bread. So it's like breaking bread with someone.
I
And I'm
like
sure
that.
that you all have had bosses or leaders in your life, okay? Have you ever had the boss who sat across the desk from you in direct relation to the one who actually came around the desk and sat with you? Which did you prefer?
Yeah, let's sit together.
Okay.
I don't like Biden.
So here I am. I think I'm going on a bear hunt. Now I'm companioning my bear guide this week. And I don't mean, hey, get your notepad. I'm going to tell you a bunch of cool stuff. You better write it down
Right.
because I'm the expert. You better listen to me or you're going to be in trouble. It's, man, I just wanted to bring presence. You know, earlier, Claudia, you asked, what's the number one thing that you can do to mitigate suicide? Bring presence. It's not about what you say. It's not about your degree on the wall. It's about being present with someone. Okay. And so I just made myself present with him the whole week. So then the last afternoon of the last hunt, we're all going to go up on the mountain together. Me and Carson and our bear guide and my buddy David and his bear guide and his two girls, we're all going to the same spot because nobody has had an opportunity to take a bear. So we're going to do this. So we take horses up about 3 hours. Have you guys ever been horseback riding up mountains, cut back roads? We go 3 hours up. Then we get off the horses and we walk another hour and a half. Okay. So we're 6,000 feet up in these mountains. We're stationed around a logging road. I don't even take my rifle up because in my mind, I'm like, this is the last afternoon. If anybody's shooting a bear with me, it's going to be my son. Okay. So I don't even take my rifle. I go up and I decide to sit with my bear guide on around the corner, and we're just glassing the mountain, and I'm just doing my best to companion him. And we start talking about, you know, loss. We start talking about, I was telling him about how a lot of, you know, people who wear uniforms, a lot of their biggest struggles are transitioning from what their identity is and what they do to then be a civilian. And I was like, you got to kind of think about this. You love bear hunting so much and you love being a guide, but there's going to come a day you're going to be old. You ain't going to be able to come up in the mountains like this. I mean, I'm almost 50, bro, and this is I felt like I've been in three MMA fights this week doing all this up and down and carrying this weight, right? And I feel like I'm pretty fit, dude, you know? And he goes, man, I
That's
never really thought about that. We start talking about his, he starts talking about his friend, and I'm just asking, what was he like? What did you love about him? What did you learn? What will you take with you? What's the legacy that he leaves with you? Not killing himself. What are the things that, you're going to live on through you, through him? And he says something to me. He goes, I'm just trying to figure out what God's trying to tell me in all of this. And I looked over at him and I said, well, have you ever asked him? I said, look, you've been walking around with me and my son. My son's 25. He's an adult. And yeah, I'm his dad, but I don't give unsolicited advice or prescriptions or stuff. He's his own man right now. If he comes to ask me, that's a totally different thing because of the relationship. I said, but we haven't been walking down these trails and maybe even like, hey, Carson, you better do this or you better do that. I'm your parent. You're gonna be put on restriction. I said, and look, God's the same way with his children. It, yes, if we're in danger, if my adult kids are in the street and I see a car coming, I'm gonna yell, right? But when it comes to just life and living day to day, the Bible says that God is a still small voice, right? And when the Bible says draw near to God and he'll draw near to you, who draws first? We do, right? And so I said, maybe just look at how me and my son have interacted. And when you start to think about, just ask God. He's waiting for you to ask, but he's not going to give you just unsolicited information. So we finished that conversation. There's 2 hours left of light. So I'm thinking to myself, I haven't hunted next to my best friend David all week long. I'm going to go sit with him for this last 2 hours. So I walk a couple thousand yards around the mountain and I'm getting over to him and he's actually on his phone, right? He's on his phone. He's not even paying attention. David is an amazing guy, but just probably not, his first time bear hunting and hadn't been hunting too much. So typically you're not going to see something if you're on your phone.
That's not
And
how it works.
I get over there and he's super excited. We start chucking it up. Then his girls walk over and we're talking. We're being loud. We are not like it. This is not the atmosphere conducive for
For
bear.
hunting.
But when I was sitting there with him, he was asking me a bunch of questions about shooting and shooting his rifle. And what if you had to make that 600 yard shot in comparison to this one? So we were going through the MOA guidelines of his ammunition and his rifle. And, I was an Army Cav Scout. I've shot tens of thousands of rounds, as a scout sniper. So shooting is something I'm pretty good at. And we're sitting there, we're being super loud. And as I'm looking through him, 300 yards away, a bear steps out onto the road. And I'm like, there's a bear. Well, the guides are a thousand yards away from us with my son glassing because he's the one that's going to get a shot because they'd seen this bear coming through this area like 700 yards and they got him set up. And I'm like, yeah, well, he's a scout sniper too. So he's the guy, right? And so immediately I shift to, I've got to be the guide. So I'm like, girls, grab your backpacks. So we stack up the backpacks. We establish a good shooting rest. And David's daughter, Kennedy, jumps up there. And so she's got her rifle. And I'm like, I've ranged the bear. I'm like 303 yards. Okay, Kennedy, what is your MOA adjustment for 300 yards? She goes, I don't know. My guide has the chart. And I'm like, that's not good. Now, all of this is happening in like quick pace because this bear is only going to stand on this road for so long and then it's going to go 600 feet down this ridge. Okay. So this is happening quick. I'm like, okay, David, we were just talking about your rifle. Hand me your rifle. So we put David's rifle up there. I'd already been through the chart for 15 minutes. So I already knew the MOA at 300 yards was 3.8. I'm like, okay, Kennedy, make the adjustment for 3.8. She goes, I don't know how. I look at Maitland, his other daughter. I've said, do you know how? She goes, no. David? No, they all said in almost unison, you take the shot. So I jump on the rifle. I already know 3.8. I'm making the adjustment. And all of a sudden, click, He had been sitting on the side of the mountain and never chambered a round into that rifle. It was not even ready to shoot. So I go to chamber
Oh
a
my
round and
gosh.
it jams. And I'm not talking
Oh
about like a nice little
no. Right.
jam. I'm talking about this thing is jammed to where I have to drop the magazine,
Oh,
then physically take a
gosh.
round, put it in. I'm back down. Bam, 300 yards. The bear ran 20 yards. Good ethical shot, right? And David said afterward, he goes, "Man, it seemed like you did all that in like 3 seconds." I'm like, "I got a little experience doing this, okay,
Right.
as far as getting a jam." But I purposed to go up on that mountain without my rifle because I was not going to be the one taking the shot. I had spent that entire week purpose to pour into my bear guide because he had experienced a loss. And here, the Lord purposes for me to be able to be the one to harvest a mature black bear, which is like, getting struck by lightning. Okay.
Right.
And you know what? That was super cool, but I wouldn't trade it for the conversations with my bear guide that week because that was the real important piece. And this is the picture of the sun going down that night afternoon as our bear guides went down the trail. Remember, I said we went 3 hours up on horseback and then walked an hour and a half. They went all the way down. So we actually built a fire on the logging road as they went down and just sat around the fire and just talked about, and this was the backdrop of that. So that's my story.
I love it. Well, and I look at it too from a perspective of you're being obedient. You were being at the right place at the right time. You had an open heart and you allowed God to work through you to minister to a broken and hurting person. So, one, you blessed that person. And then in return, God was like, you were obedient. I'm going to bless you. And you got your sunset, you got your bear, but you also come back with, how much connection did you make? Like, you keep talking about the how blessed you were based on that conversation, but think
What
about
about
the
everybody
bear guide.
else? Right. Yeah.
I really operate or live by what I call a one-shot mentality. Because in my day job, I might get one conversation with someone, and in life, sometimes God will put people in our paths. We might get one shot. And so every time I meet someone with pain, I treat it like it might be the only shot I get to connect, to reach them, to give them a reason to stay, right? And that changes the way you show up with people. And it reminds me, and it should remind you, that even one conversation can save a life. Just one. Just showing up. Just being present. That's it.
And that makes me, because I say this a lot too, because like I'm a big Carnegie fan, and one of the best things that that man ever did was make people feel important and make them feel seen. And that's the biggest thing, especially when people are hurting, they're in their feelings, they're in trauma. Again, just the smallest ounce of hope, knowing that you're seen, that you feel important, somebody makes you feel important, like that carries so much weight. And the fact that you were able to do that with this bear guide who was obviously hurting because their friend took their life, like you made him feel important. I'm assuming it was him.
Yeah, it was.
But you made him feel important, made him feel seen. And that is 100% us being the hands and feet of Jesus. It's never about us converting people or being like, bro, you need to get into heaven. It's like that's the Holy Spirit's job. Like our job is just to be the hands and feet of Jesus. And sometimes that is just having a good conversation with somebody or sending them a text message and be like, hey, just checking in on you. Crossed my mind today. Like, how many times does that actually happen? Like, and I'll be honest, it happens to me all the time and I don't act on it all the time. But how often is that somebody crosses your mind? Like, that's the Holy Spirit saying, hey, maybe you should be the one to check in on them. So I feel like also as people, we need to be a little bit more in tune with those nudges from the Holy Spirit because that's Him trying to use us to reach the hurting people.
Absolutely. Yes.
Carter, I know we could talk to you forever, to be honest with you, and I want
You
to be
have to come back.
respectful. Yes, so you have to come back. I want to be respectful of your time though. So, I'm going to ask you, you have a cool tattoo story, so we
Yes.
want to hear about that. And you're going to have to save another tattoo story because, again, you're going to have to come back. So, share with us your best tattoo story.
Yeah, so I'm definitely gonna have to come back because we didn't even really talk about what happened to me when I was in the army, right?
I know,
And
like,
this is directly connected to that. So just to sum it up real quick,
great.
when
Cliff,
I
you
was
take
in
your
South,
time. Yeah, you take your time.
when I was in South Korea, I was 18 years old. I'd been off post. My platoon sergeant was leaving. He was PCSing back to the States, so we had a big party. And me and my battle buddy were in a section of like bars and clubs, you know, that was right through there. That was cars weren't allowed to drive in this space, okay? And so a car comes whipping through and almost runs us over. And we're like, look, you don't have to know the language to have like the universal language, right? Of like, what's going on here, right?
Everybody
And
knows that one.
so, yeah. And so it was a carload of South Korean, I'm going to call them men. I was 18, okay? Was I a man? I'm not sure, but I was definitely trained and really good at what I do. So I kind of pushed my battle buddy into this bar and let the car go on. And when we come back out, we notice it's like, oof, we got to be back on post at 3. It's like quarter till. And trust me, if you know anything about it, you do not want to be off post after the gates have been closed. Okay. You're going to be pulling duty and guard and you're going to be in trouble.
It can
Okay.
be bad.
So we start making our way back and it's 15 minutes, you know, that we need to be through the gate, but it's a 10-minute walk. So we're double timing. Okay. So we get up there, and this car had pulled off to the side, and these guys were standing outside now talking to a female outside of a club, and they recognized us when we came by. And they surrounded us. And as we're talking, one of them pulls a knife, and he's in my battle buddy's blind side. So I didn't think twice about it. I just unloaded on him and dropped him right there. Okay. Long story short, we get into the details of it another time. It was 5-on-2. We put three in the hospital, and one of them was the son of a Korean dignitary. So the army offered us up to be prosecuted for assault and battery, which carried a life sentence in prison because it became a political thing.
Oh my
So for
gosh.
9 months, here I am on the other side of the world. For 9 months, we'd go to court once a month, and the jury at the end of 9 months found us guilty. And I'm sitting there and, you know, they're talking in Korean and you can tell that they found us guilty because everybody who was against us is really excited. And I don't know if you guys are football fans or anything, but you ever been watching the game and your team kicks the field goal and it's for the win and you're super excited, but then everybody's like, no, there's a flag, right? And you're like, oh, you're so ecstatic and excited, but now there's a flag on the play. Well, the judge starts speaking again, and it's like, okay, there's a flag on the play because everybody who's super excited is now not excited at all. And you can tell by their tone, by their disposition, that they are not happy.
No.
So now I'm like, what is going on? Because we didn't have really good representation. Like our attorney spoke broken English. So here we are. Yeah, we're on trial for our life, right? I'm an American soldier on the other side of the world, serving my country, protecting their country, in trial for life in prison.
Oh
Okay.
my gosh.
You just think in my mind, like, what are they going to do to an American soldier every day the rest of my life in prison?
Right. It's not going to be good. No.
No. And, you know, I won't get into the weeds of it, but after this first happened, that's one of the only times in my life I ever thought about taking my own life because I thought, you know, I threw the first punch. I knew I was defending the situation, but you know, the way they looked, the way they came against us, it was like, I'm guilty, right? And it was actually that weekend that I gave my life to the Lord. I didn't grow up in church or anything. It was that weekend after thinking I'm going to take my life, I ended up in a service and got born again. So we'll talk about that another time. But in there, the judge starts talking to us. And in the South Korean judicial system, it's one of the only types where the judge can change the verdict. So what he did was he berated us for conduct unbecoming, even though you were defending, you needed to be do the right thing, blah, blah, blah. But he said, look, I'm not going to send you to prison in my country. What I am going to do is I'm going to ban you from ever coming back to my country after you end service. Cool. Cool that.
I know
And
a lot of
deal.
soldiers
Yeah.
that would.
Come
My
on.
brother is stationed
And
in South Korea. He would have done the
come
same thing.
on. And so that was really like my Daniel in the Lion's Den situation, right? It was through that situation, that look, I broke my wrist in that punch. Okay. And what shattered in Korea wasn't just my wrist, it was my moral center. Because the betrayal of what had happened, when I came back stateside and I had a cast for 6 months. For 6 months, it was from here down.
Oh my
And I mean, for
gosh.
2 months, and then 2 months from here down, and then 2 months from here down. I'm like, Doc, just make sure my trigger finger's good. Okay. I need to be able to hold, shoot my weapon. But what happened is, can you imagine being in a cast for 6 months, the atrophy of my
Oh yeah.
wrist? So I couldn't
Horrible.
do a military standard push-up. So I couldn't complete a PT test. So even though I was a squared away soldier, I was always the platoon sergeant or the lieutenant's gunner or driver. I was the sniper of the battalion. Because I couldn't do a PT test, that was a box that was like a deficiency. Well, that was cool in Korea because they knew my story. When I came stateside, my platoon sergeant didn't know my story and he treated me less than. He treated me as a bad check on his report. So anytime there was crappy duty, and I mean like burn barrel, burning crap duty or holiday duty or anything, I was the one who got chose for that. And it, my sense of right and wrong, I had done the right thing in that situation, but I was still getting punished. I was still getting discarded. So this was my first encounter with what I know as moral injury. That wound to your soul, not just to your skin. And so it's what happens when your values get so vi get violated so deeply that you start to really question who you are and whether you even deserve to come back from it. And unlike PTSD, which is that based in fear, moral injury is really based in shame and betrayal. And it's not just I'm not safe, it's I'm not good anymore. And that was the hardest part. Those are the kinds of wounds, like I said, that don't have funerals. And no one shows up to grieve with you, right? There's no marker, there's no ceremony. It's just silence of having to carry it alone. And you look fine on the outside, but on the inside, you're grieving something that died in you. And no one even knows it's gone except you, right? So, which brings me to the tattoo. After everything in Korea, I got an ankh tattooed in the center of my back, done the old way, tapped with bamboo. And I didn't even understand the symbol fully at the time, but now I do. The ankh means eternal life. And even though it's a pagan symbol, it's on the middle of my back, it will always be there because it means life. And somehow, even in all the pain, I marked myself with the symbol that said, I'm still here. I'm still here. It hurt like crap. I mean, that band, the bamboo way, I'm telling you, just be prepared for that. But you know what? That pain felt right. It was sacred. And if I had to get another one, I'd probably get one that says, you are still here. But because that phrase has saved lives, including mine. But yeah, that's my tattoo story. It's still there.
Okay, like how big is it? Like, how much of your back is it?
It's about the size of that broadhead right there in the middle of my back. Yeah, not super big, but it's definitely see it. It's
How
there.
long? How long does that take with the bamboo?
Yeah. Oof, it felt like it took forever.
Right, like 7 years.
And the worst part is, I had kind of let down drinking, and I think that drinking would have really helped that
For sure.
situation in that moment. You know, some soju juice, a little rice liquor. But it definitely took a couple of hours. It's all
Oh my
black. It's not
gosh.
multicolored, so it's just the pattern. But yeah, that's my tattoo story.
Wow. Well, Carter, where can people find you? So if they want to connect with you, or if they want to find your book, which Jen,
Yeah.
we're going to have to grab that,
Oh, 100%.
where can people find you?
Yeah, so really easy. DrCarterCheck.com. There's links to my nonprofit Hunt Therapy there. There's links to get the book there. If you don't want to go to Dr. Carter Check, you can just do healinginthewild.com and it'll take you straight
Okay.
to get the book. I try to make it simple as possible.
I see, thank you for that. I love that.
Yeah.
And then just for our audience too, like you're on socials too, so they can follow you
Yes,
and connect with you
yes.
that way too.
Yep,
Perfect.
absolutely. Dr. Carter Check on Facebook, Instagram, look me up, follow me, give me likes. I don't need your like, but I think that what you might find, like I said, I really, if I pride myself off of anything, it's walking with people in such a way that you don't feel like you're being talk to, but you're just walking down a trail. We're walking down a trail, and maybe I've got some insight into something. You know, one thing I hate are cliches like time heals all wounds. It's a lie. It doesn't exist. That's not true, right? And I really am passionate about bringing what God calls sacred that the enemy has tried to pervert, like mindfulness and breath work and meditation, and make them mystical or something like that.
Right.
I really feel that I do a really good job of just conversating about things that happen in life. And here's what I want someone to know out there. If you're suffering from a moral injury, if you've heard that and you're like, man, I think this is what I'm dealing with, know this, that moral injury is not a sign of a deficiency within you. It's actually a highlight of the best part of you. Because if you didn't have morals, you wouldn't hurt. It wouldn't even matter. So hear that and know that if you're working through a moral injury, you're working towards moral repair because it matters. If you were a psychopath or a sociopath, you wouldn't care. So definitely lean into that and don't do it alone, walk with somebody.
You've been amazing. I definitely know that you have to come back and do probably 7 more episodes, because I think that's how much
You can
that.
almost be like me, because that's how I started. I was
Yes,
just a guest, and then
come on,
that's how
come on.
Jen
It's gonna be
started.
us. We're gonna do this.
That's
It's awesome.
right. The
That's
dynamic
right. Come
trio.
on.
That's
Come
right.
on.
We're getting the gang together.
Let's heal the
In all
people.
seriousness, Carter, you're amazing, and I'm so grateful that we got to spend this time with you. And yay for the audience. But I'm going to be selfish right now. Yay for me, because this has been, you have no idea. You have no idea how meaningful this has been for me, how many notes I
Well,
took, how many things you said that truly resonated with things I'm going through or things I've been through. And I'm just so appreciative that God brought you here today to spend that time. So thank you.
come on. Thank you.
I would take it
Appreciate that.
one step further and just say also absolutely therapeutic.
Thank you for listening to the Strong Enough Podcast. You can find us on your favorite podcast platform by searching Strong Enough. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Strong Enough Pod. If you have suggestions for an upcoming episode or a future guest, please reach out at strongenoughpod@gmail.com. Remember, you are worth it.